Forget everything you had planned for this weekend because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator. Tonight, I've got a story for you that is truly one of the strangest tales I've ever come across, and believe it or not, it's over 100 years old. This is The Thing from Outside by George Allan England, first published in 1923. Our setup is fairly straightforward, a group of five researchers returning from the wilderness. As is to be expected in stories like these, things don't go exactly as planned. But it's how things go awry that really makes this one work. This is weird fiction with a capital W, folks, and has some horror concepts that are decades beyond what was being written at the time. You'll have to deal with some antiquated language, but stick with it. This one chills to the bone. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author George Allan England, I give you The Thing from Outside. They sat about their campfire, that little party of Americans retreating southward from Hudson Bay before the oncoming menace of the great cold. Sat there, stolid under the awe of the North, under the uneasiness that the day's trek had laid upon their souls. The three men smoked. The two women huddled close to each other. Fire glow picked their faces from the gloom of night among the dwarf firs. A splashing murmur told of the Albany River's haste to escape from the wilderness and reach the bay.
I don't see what there was in the mere circular print on a rock ledge to make our guides desert, said Professor Thorburn. His voice was as dry as his whole personality. Most extraordinary. They knew what it was, all right, answered Jandrin, geologist of the party. So do I. He rubbed his cropped mustache. His eyes glinted grayly. I've seen prints like that before. That was on the Labrador. And I've seen things happen where they were. Something surely happened to our guides before they got a mile into the bush, put in the professor's wife, while Vivian, her sister, gazed into the fire that revealed her as a beauty, not to be spoiled even by a tam and a rough-knit sweater. Men don't shoot wildly and scream like that, unless... They're all three dead now, anyhow, put in Jandrin, so they're out of harm's way, while we... Well, we're 250 wicked miles from the CPR rails. Forget it, Jandri, said Mar, the journalist. We're just suffering from an attack of nerves, that's all. Give me a fill of baccy. Thanks. We'll all be better in the morning. Now, speaking of spooks and such... He launched into an account of how he had once exposed a fraudulent spiritualist, thus proving, to his own satisfaction, that nothing existed beyond the scope of mankind's everyday life. But nobody gave him much heed, and silence fell upon the little night encampment in the wilds, a silence that was ominous. Pale, cold stars watched down from spaces infinitely far beyond man's trivial world. Next day, stopping for chow on a ledge miles upstream, Jandrin discovered another of the prints. He cautiously summoned the other two men. They examined the print while the womenfolk were busy by the fire. A harmless thing, the marking seemed. Only a ring about 4 inches in diameter, a kind of cup-shaped depression with a raised center. A sort of glaze coated it, as if the granite had been fused by heat. Jandrin knelt, a well-knit figure in bright mackinaw and canvas leggings, and with a shaking finger explored the smooth curve of the print in the rock. His brows contracted as he studied it. "We'd better get along out of this as quick as we can," said he in an unnatural voice. "You've got your wife to protect, Thorburn, and I... Well, I've got Vivian, and..." "You have," nipped Mar. The light of an evil jealousy gleamed in his heavy-lidded look. "What you need is an alienist."
"Really, Jandrin," the professor admonished. "You mustn't let your imagination run away with you."
"I suppose it's imagination that keeps this print cold," the geologist retorted, his breath made faint, swirling coils of vapor above it.
"Nothing but a pothole," judged Thorburn,
bending his spare, angular body to examine the print. The professor's vitality all seemed centered in his big, bulged skull that sheltered a marvelous thinking machine. Now he put his lean hand to the base of his brain, rubbing the back of his head as if it ached. Then, under what seemed some powerful compulsion, he ran his bony finger around the print in the rock.
"By Jove, but it is cold," he admitted, "and looks as if it had been stamped right out of the stone. Extraordinary."
"Dissolved out, you mean," corrected the geologist. "By cold." The journalist laughed mockingly. "Wait till I write this up," he sneered. "Noted geologist declares frigid ghost dissolves granite." Jandrin ignored him. He fetched a little water from the river and poured it into the print.
"Ice!" ejaculated the professor. "Solid ice."
"Frozen in a second," added Jandrin, while Mar frankly stared. "And it'll never melt either. I tell you, I've seen some of these rings before, but every time, horrible things have happened. Incredible things. Something burned this ring out of the stone, burned it out with the cold interstellar space. Something that can import cold as a permanent quality of matter, something that can kill matter and totally remove it."
Of course, that's all sheer poppycock. The journalist tried to laugh, but his brain felt numb. This something, this thing, continued Jandrin, is a thing that can't be killed by bullets. It's what caught our guides on the Barrens as they ran away. Poor fools. A shadow fell across the print in the rock. Mrs. Thorburn had come up, was standing there. She had overheard a little of what Jandrin had been saying. Nonsense, she tried to exclaim, but she was shivering so she could hardly speak. That night, after a long afternoon of paddling and portaging, laboring against inhibitions like those in a nightmare, they camped on shelving rocks that slanted to the river. After all, said the professor when supper was done, we mustn't get into a panic. I know extraordinary things are reported from the wilderness, and more than one man has come out raving. But we, by Jove, with our superior brains, we aren't going to let nature play us any tricks. And of course, added his wife, her arm about Vivian, everything in the universe is a natural force. There's really no supernatural at all. Admitted, Jandrin replied, but how about things outside the universe? And they call you a scientist? Jibed Mar, but the professor leaned forward, his brows knit. Huh, he grunted. A little silence fell. You don't mean, really, asked Vivian, that you think there's life and intelligence outside? Jandrin looked at the girl. Her beauty, haloed with ruddy gold from the firelight, was a pain to him as he answered. Yes, I do. And dangerous life, too. I know what I've seen in the North Country. I know what I've seen. Silence again, save for the crepitation of the flames, the fall of an ember, the murmur of the current. Darkness narrowed the wilderness to just that circle of flickering light ringed by the forest and the river, brooded over by the pale stars. Of course you can't expect a scientific man to take you seriously, commented the professor. I know what I've seen. I tell you, there's something entirely outside man's knowledge. Poor fellow, scoffed the journalist, but even as he spoke, his hand pressed his forehead. There are things at work, Jandrin affirmed with dogged persistence. He lighted his pipe with a blazing twig. Its flame revealed his face, drawn, lined. Things that reckon with us no more than we do with ants. Less, perhaps. The flame of the twig died. Night stood closer, watching. Suppose there are, the girl asked. What's that got to do with these prints in the rock? They, answered Jandrin, are marks left by one of those things. Footprints, maybe. That thing is near us, here and now. Mar's laugh broke a long stillness. And you, he exclaimed, with an AM and a B asteroid after your name. If you knew more, retorted Jandrin, you'd know a devilish sight less. It's only ignorance that's cocksure. But, dogmatized the professor, no scientist of any standing has ever admitted any outside interference with this planet. No, and for thousands of years, nobody ever admitted that the world was round either. What I've seen, I know. Well, what have you seen? Asked Mrs. Thorburn, shivering. You'll excuse me, please, for not going into that just now. You mean, the professor demanded dryly, if the... this supposititious thing wants to... It'll do any infernal thing it takes a fancy to, yes, if it happens to want us. But what could things like that want of us? Why should they come here at all? Oh, for various reasons. For inanimate objects at times, and then again for living beings. They've come here a lot of times, I tell you, Jandrin asserted with strange irritation. And got what they wanted, and then gone away to... somewhere. If one of them happens to want us, for any reason, it will take us,
That's all. If it doesn't want us, it will ignore us, as we would ignore gorillas in Africa if we were looking for gold. But if it was gorilla fur we wanted, that would be different for the gorillas, wouldn't it?
What in the world, asked Vivian, could a thing from outside want of us?
What do men want, say, of guinea pigs? Men experiment with them, of course. Superior beings use inferior for their own ends. To assume that man is the supreme product of evolution is gross self-conceit. Might not some superior thing want to experiment with human beings?
But how?
Demanded Marr. The human brain is the most highly organized form of matter known to this planet. Suppose now...
Nonsense, interrupted the professor. All hands to the sleeping bags, and no more of this. I've got a wretched headache. Let's anchor in Blanket Bay.
He and both the women turned in. Jandrin and Marr sat a while longer by the fire. They kept plenty of wood piled on it, too, for an unnatural chill transfixed the night air. The fire burned strangely blue, with greenish flicks of flame. At length, after vast acerbities of disagreement, the geologist and the newspaperman sought their sleeping bags. The fire was a comfort. Not that a fire could avail a pin's weight against a thing from interstellar space, but subjectively, it was a comfort. The instincts of a million years, centering around protection by fire, cannot be obliterated. After a time, worn out by a day of nerve strain and of battling with swift currents, a flight from something invisible, intangible, they all slept. The depths of space, star-sprinkled, hung above them with vastness immeasurable, cold beyond all understanding of the human mind.
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Jandrin woke first in a red dawn. He blinked at the fire as he crawled from his sleeping bag. The fire was dead, and yet it had not burned out. Much wood remained unconsumed, charred over, as if some gigantic extinguisher had in the night been lowered over it. Growled Jandrin. He glanced about him on the ledge.
Prince, too. I might have known.
He aroused Marr. Despite all the journalists' mocking hostility, Jandrin felt more in common with this man of his own age than with the professor, who was close on 60.
"Look here now," said he. "It has been all around. See? It put out our fire. Maybe the fire annoyed it in some way. And it walked round us everywhere."
His gray eyes smoldered.
"I guess, by God, you've got to admit facts now."
The journalist could only shiver and stare.
"Lord, what a head I've got on me this morning," he chattered.
He rubbed his forehead with a shaking hand and started for the river. Most of his assurance had vanished. He looked badly done up.
"Well, what say?" demanded Jandrin. "See these fresh prints?" "Damn the prints," retorted Marr, and fell to grumbling some unintelligible thing.
He washed unsteadily and remained crouching at the river's lip, inert, numbed. Jandrin, despite a gnawing at the base of his brain, carefully examined the ledge.
He found prints scattered everywhere, and some even on the river bottom near the shore. Wherever water had collected in the prints on the rock, it had frozen hard. Each print in the riverbed, too, was white with ice. Ice that the rushing current could not melt.
"Oh, by God!"
he exclaimed. He lighted his pipe and tried to think. Horribly afraid. Yes, he felt horribly afraid, but determined. Presently, as a little power of concentration came back, he noticed that all the prints were in straight lines, each mark about 2 feet from the next.
"It was observing us while we slept," said Jandrin.
"What nonsense are you talking, eh?"
demanded Mar. His dark, heavy face sagged.
"Fire, now, and grub!"
He got up and shuffled unsteadily away from the river. Then he stopped with a jerk, staring.
Look at that axe!"
he gulped, pointing. Jandrin picked up the axe by the handle, taking good care not to touch the steel. The blade was white-furred with frost, and deep into it, punching out part of the edge, one of the prints was stamped.
"This metal," said he, "is clean gone. It's been absorbed. The thing doesn't recognize any difference in materials. Water and steel and rock are all the same to it."
"You're crazy," snarled the journalist. "How could a thing travel on one leg, hopping along, making marks like that?"
"It could roll, if it was disc-shaped and..."
A cry from the professor turned them. Thorburn was stumbling toward them, hands out and tremulous.
"My wife,"
he choked. Vivian was kneeling beside her sister, frightened, dazed.
"Something's happened,"
stammered the professor.
"Here, come here."
Mrs. Thorburn was beyond any power of theirs to help. She was still breathing, but her respirations were stertorous, and a complete paralysis had stricken her. Her eyes, half open and expressionless, showed pupils startlingly dilated. No resource of the party's drug kit produced the slightest effect on the woman. The next half hour was a confused panic, breaking camp, getting Mrs. Thorburn into a canoe, and leaving that accursed place with a furious energy of terror that could no longer reason. Upstream, ever up against the swirl of the current, the party fought, driven by horror. With no thought of food or drink, paying no heed to landmarks, lashed forward only by the mad desire to be gone, the three men and the girl flung every ounce of their energy into the paddles. Their panting breath mingled with the sound of swirling eddies. A mist-blurred sun brooded over the northern wilds. Unheeded, hosts of black flies sang high-pitched keenings all about the fugitives. On either hand, the forest waited, watched. Only after 2 hours of sweating toil had brought exhaustion did they stop, in the shelter of a cove where black waters circled, foam-flecked. There, they found the professor's wife. She was dead. Nothing remained to do but bury her. At first, Thorburn would not hear of it. Like a madman, he insisted that, through all hazards, he would fetch the body out. But no. Impossible. So, after a terrible time, he yielded. In spite of her grief, Vivian was admirable. She understood what must be done. It was her voice that said the prayers, her hand that, lacking flowers, laid the fir boughs on the cairn. The professor was dazed past doing anything, saying anything. Toward mid-afternoon, the party landed again many miles upriver. Necessity forced them to eat. Firs would not burn. Every time they lighted it, it smoldered and went out with a heavy, greasy smoke. The fugitives ate cold food and drank water, then shoved off in two canoes and once more fled. In the third canoe, hauled to the edge of the forest, lay all the rock specimens, data, and curios, scientific instruments. The party kept only Mars' diary, a compass, supplies, firearms, and medicine kit. We can find the things we've left sometime, said Jandrin, noting the place well. Sometime after it has gone.
And bring the body out,
added Thorburn. Tears, for the first time, wet his eyes. Vivian said nothing. Mar tried to light his pipe. He seemed to forget that nothing, not even tobacco, would burn now. Vivian and Jandrin occupied one canoe. The other carried the professor and Mar. Thus, the power of the two canoes was about the same. They kept well together upstream. The fugitives paddled and portaged with a dumb, desperate energy. Toward evening, they struck into what they believed to be the Mamatawan. A mile up this, as the blurred sun faded beyond a wilderness of ominous silence, they camped. Here, they made determined efforts to kindle fire. Not even alcohol from the drug kit would start it. Cold, they mumbled a little food. Cold, they huddled into their sleeping bags, there to lie with darkness leaden on their fear. After a long time, up over a world void of all sound save the river flow, slid an amber moon notched by the ragged tops of the conifers. Even the wail of a timber wolf would have come as welcome relief, but no wolf howled. Silence and night enfolded them, and everywhere they felt that it was watching. Foolishly enough, as a man will do foolish things in a crisis, Jandrin laid his revolver outside his sleeping bag in easy reach. His thought, blurred by a strange, drawing headache, was, "If it touches Vivian, I'll shoot." He realized the complete absurdity of trying to shoot a visitant from interstellar space, from the fourth dimension, maybe. But Jandrin's ideas seemed tangled. Nothing would come right. He lay there, absorbed in a kind of waking nightmare. Now and then, rising on an elbow, he hearkened. All in vain. Nothing so much as stirred. His thought drifted to better days, when all had been health, sanity, optimism, when nothing except jealousy of Mar, as concerned Vivian, had troubled him. Days when the sizzle of the frying pan over friendly coals had made friendly wilderness music, when the wind and the northern star, the whir of the reel, the whispering vortex of the paddle and clear water, had all been things of joy. Yes, and when a certain happy moment had, through some word or look of the girl, seemed to promise his heart's desire. But now, "Damn it, I'll save her anyhow," he swore with savage intensity, knowing all the while that what was to be would be unmitigably. Do ants, by any waving of antenna, stay the down-crushing foot of man? Next morning, and the next, no sign of the thing appeared. Hope revived the possibility it might have flitted away elsewhere, back perhaps to outer space. Many were the miles the urging paddles spurned behind. The fugitives calculated that a week more would bring them to the railroad. Fire burned again. Hot food and drink helped wonderfully. But where were the fish?
"Most extraordinary,"
all at once said the professor at noonday camp. He had become quite rational again.
"Do you realize, Jandrin, we've seen no traces of life in some time?"
The geologist nodded. Only too clearly he had noted just that, but he had been keeping still about it.
"That's so too," chimed in Mar, enjoying the smoke that some incomprehensible turn of events was letting him have. "Not a muskrat or beaver, not even a squirrel or bird."
"Not so much as a gnat or black fly," the professor added.
Jandrin suddenly realized that he would have welcomed even those. That afternoon, Mar fell into a suddenly vile temper. He mumbled curses against the guides, the current, the portages, everything. The professor seemed more cheerful. Vivian complained of an oppressive headache. Jandrin gave her the last of the aspirin tablets, and as he gave them, took her hand in his. I'll see you through, anyhow, said he. I don't count now. Nobody counts. Only you. She gave him a long, silent look. He saw the sudden glint of tears in her eyes, felt the pressure of her hand, and knew they two had never been so near each other as in that moment, under the shadow of the unknown. Next day, or it may have been 2 days later, for none of them could be quite sure about the passage of time, they came to a deserted lumber camp. Even more than 2 days might have passed, because now their bacon was all gone, and only coffee, tobacco, beef cubes, and pilot bread remained. The lack of fish and game had cut alarmingly into the duffel bag. That day, whatever day it may have been, all four of them suffered terribly from headaches of an odd ring-shaped kind, as if something circular were being pressed down about their heads. The professor said it was the sun that made his headache. Vivian laid it to the wind and the gleam of the swift water, while Mar claimed it was the heat. Jandrin wondered at all this, inasmuch as he plainly saw that the river had almost stopped flowing and the day had become still and overcast. They dragged their canoes upon a rotting stage of fir poles and explored the lumber camp, a mournful place set back in an old slash, now partly overgrown with scrub poplar, maple, and birch. The log buildings, covered with tar paper partly torn from the pole roofs, were of the usual North Country type. Obviously, the place had not been used for years. Even the landing stage where once logs had been rolled into the stream had sagged to decay.
"I don't quite get the idea of this," Mar exclaimed. "Where did the logs go to? Downstream, of course, but that would take them to Hudson Bay, and there's no market for spruce timber or pulpwood at Hudson Bay." He pointed down the current.
"You're entirely mistaken," put in the professor. "Any fool could see this river runs the other way. A log thrown in here would go down toward the St. Lawrence."
"But then," asked the girl, "why can't we drift back to civilization?"
The professor retorted,
"Just what we have been doing all along. Extraordinary that I have to explain the obvious."
He walked away in a huff.
"I don't know, but he's right at that," half admitted the journalist. "I've been thinking almost the same thing myself the past day or two. That is, ever since the sun shifted."
"What do you mean, shifted?" From Jandrin.
"You haven't noticed it?"
"But there's been no sun at all for at least 2 days.
"Hanged if I'll waste time arguing with a lunatic," Mar growled. He vouchsafed no explanation of what he meant by the sun's having shifted, but wandered off, grumbling.
"What are we going to do?" The girl appealed to Jandrin. The sight of her solemn, frightened eyes, of her palm outward hands, and, at last, her very feminine fear, constricted Jandrin's heart.
"We're going through, you and I," he answered simply. "We've got to save them from themselves, you and I have." Their hands met again, and for a moment held. Despite the dead calm, a fir tip at the edge of the clearing suddenly flicked aside, shriveled as if frozen. But neither of them saw it.
Forget everything you had planned for this weekend because you are sitting on your couch and winning from the comfort of your own home. I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play hundreds of slot games, all of the table games you love, and you could even win real cash prizes. New users, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
The fugitives, badly spent,
established themselves in the bar room or sleeping shack of the camp. They wanted to feel a roof over them again, if only a broken one. The traces of men comforted them. A couple of broken peavies, a pair of snowshoes with the thongs all gnawed off, a cracked bit of mirror, a yellowed almanac dated 1899. Jandrin called the professor's attention to this almanac, but the professor thrust it aside.
"What do I want of a Canadian census report?"
he demanded, and fell to counting the bunks over and over again. His big bulge of his forehead, that housed the massive brain of him, was oozing sweat. Mar cursed what he claimed was sunshine through the holes in the roof, though Jandrin could see none, claimed the sunshine made his head ache.
"But it's not a bad place," he added. "We can make a blaze in that fireplace and be comfy. I don't like that window, though."
"What window?" asked Jandrin. "Where?" Mar laughed and ignored him. Jandrin turned to Vivian, who had sunk down on the deacon seat and was staring at the stove.
"Is there a window here?" he demanded.
"Don't ask me," she whispered.
I don't know."
With a very thriving fear in his heart, Jandrin peered at her a moment. He fell to muttering,
"I'm Wallace Jandrin. Wallace Jandrin, 37 Ware Street, Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm quite sane, and I'm going to stay so. I'm going to save her. I know perfectly well what I'm doing, and I'm sane. Quite, quite sane."
After a time of confused and purposeless wrangling, they got a fire going and made coffee. This and cube bouillon with hardtack helped considerably. The camp helped, too. A house, even a poor and broken one, is a wonderful barrier against a thing from outside. Presently, darkness folded down. The men smoked, thankful that tobacco still held out. Vivian lay in a bunk that Jandrin had piled with spruce boughs for her and seemed to sleep. The professor fretted like a child over the blisters his paddle had made upon his hands. Mar laughed now and then, though what he might be laughing at was not apparent. Suddenly, he broke out.
"After all, what should it want of us?"
"Our brains, of course," the professor answered sharply.
"That lets Jandrin out," the journalist mocked.
"But," added the professor, "I can't imagine a thing callously destroying human beings. And yet..."
He stopped short, with surging memories of his dead wife.
"What was it," Jandrin asked, "that destroyed all those people in Valladolid, Spain? That time so many of them died in a few minutes after having been touched by an invisible something that left a slight red mark on each? The newspapers were full of it."
"Piffle,"
yawned Mar.
"I tell you," insisted Jandrin, "there are forms of life as superior to us as we are to ants. We can't see them. No ant ever saw a man. And did any ant ever form the least conception of a man? These things have left thousands of traces all over the world. If I had my reference books..."
"Tell that to the Marines."
"Charles Fort, the greatest authority in the world on unexplained phenomena," persisted Jandrin, "gives innumerable cases of happenings that science can't explain in his Book of the Damned. He claims this earth was once a no-man's land where all kinds of things explored and colonized and fought for possession. And he says that now everybody's warned off, except the owners. I happen to remember a few sentences of his. In the past, inhabitants of a host of worlds have dropped here, hopped here, wafted here, sailed, flown, motored, walked here, have come singly, have come in enormous numbers, have visited for hunting, trading, mining. They've been unable to stay here, have made colonies here, have been lost here."
"Poor fish to believe that,"
mocked the journalist, while the professor blinked and rubbed his bulging forehead.
"I do believe it," insisted Jandrin.
The world is covered with relics of dead civilizations that have mysteriously vanished, leaving nothing but their temples and monuments. Rubbish. How about Easter Island? How about all the gigantic works there and in a thousand other places? Peru, Yucatan, and so on, which certainly no primitive race ever built. That's thousands of years ago, said Mar, and I'm sleepy. For heaven's sake, can it? Oh, all right, but how explain things then?
What the devil could one of those things want of our brains? Suddenly put in the professor. After all, what?
Well, what do we want of lower forms of life? Sometimes food, again, some product or other, or just information. Maybe it is just experimenting with us, the way we poke an anthill. There's always this to remember, that the human brain tissue is the most highly organized form of matter in this world.
Yes, admitted the professor.
But what? It might want brain tissue for food, for experimental purposes, for lubricant. How do I know?
Jandrin fancied he was still explaining things, but all at once he found himself waking up in one of the bunks. He felt terribly cold, stiff, sore. A sift of snow lay here and there on the camp floor, where it had fallen through holes in the roof.
Vivian?
He croaked hoarsely.
Thorburn! Mar!
Nobody answered. There was nobody to answer. Jandrin crawled with immense pain out of his bunk and blinked round with bleary eyes. All of a sudden, he saw the professor and gulped. The professor was lying stiff and straight in another bunk on his back. His waxen face made a mask of horror. The open, staring eyes, with pupils immensely dilated, sent Jandrin shuddering back. A livid ring marked the forehead that now sagged inward as if empty.
Vivian!
Croaked Jandrin, staggering away from the body. He fumbled to the bunk where the girl had lain. The bunk was quite deserted. On the stove, in which lay half-charred wood, wood smothered out as if by some noxious gas, still stood the coffee pot. The liquid in it was frozen solid. Of Vivian and the journalist, no trace remained. Along one of the sagging beams that supported the roof, Jandrin's horror-blasted gaze perceived a straight line of frosted prints, ring-shaped, bitten deep.
Vivian! Vivian!
No answer. Shaking, sick, gray, half-blind with a horror not of this world, Jandrin peered slowly around. The duffel bag and supplies were gone. Nothing was left but that coffee pot and the revolver at Jandrin's hip. Jandrin turned then. A stare, his skull feeling empty as a burst drum, he crept lamely to the door and out. Out into the snow. Snow. It came slanting down. From a gray sky, it steadily filtered. The trees showed no leaf. Birches, poplars, rock maples, all stood naked. Only the conifers drooped, sickly green. In a little shallow across the river, snow lay white on thin ice. Ice? Snow? Wrapped with terror, Jandrin stared. Why, then he must have been unconscious 3 or 4 weeks. But how? Suddenly, all along the upper branches of trees that edged the clearing, puffs of snow flicked down. The geologist shuffled after 2 half-obliterated sets of footprints that wavered toward the landing. His body was leaden. He wheezed as he reached the river. The light, dim as it was, hurt his eyes. He blinked in a confusion that could just perceive one canoe was gone. He pressed a hand to his head, where an iron band seemed screwed up tight, tighter.
Vivian! Mar! Hello?
Not even an echo. Silence clamped the world. Silence and a cold that gnawed.
everything had gone a sinister gray. After a certain time, though time now possessed neither reality nor duration, Jandrin dragged himself back to the camp and stumbled in. Heedless of the staring corpse, he crumpled down by the stove and tried to think, but his brain had been emptied of power. Everything blent to a gray blur. Snow kept slithering in through the roof.
"Well, then why don't you come and get me, thing?"
suddenly snarled Jandrin.
"Here I am! Damn you, come and get me!"
Voices. Suddenly, he heard voices. Yes, somebody was outside there. Singularly aggrieved, he got up and limped to the door. He squinted out into the gray, saw two figures down by the landing. With numb indifference, he recognized the girl and Mar.
"Why should they bother me again?" he nebulously wondered. "Can't they go away and leave me alone?"
He felt peevish irritation. Then, a modicum of reason returning, he sensed that they were arguing. Vivian, beside a canoe freshly dragged from thin ice, was pointing. Mar was gesticulating. All at once, Mar snarled, turned from her, plodded with bent back toward the camp.
"But listen,"
she called, her rough-knit sweater all powdered with snow.
"That's the way,"
she gestured downstream.
"I'm not going either way," Mar retorted. "I'm going to stay right here."
He came on, bareheaded. Snow grayed his stubble of beard, but on his head it melted as it fell, as if some fever there had raised the brain stuff to improbable temperatures.
"I'm going to stay right here all summer."
His heavy lids sagged. Puffy and evil, his lips showed a glint of teeth.
"Let me alone."
Vivian lagged after him, kicking up the ash-like snow. With indifference, Jandrin watched them. Trivial human creatures. Suddenly, Mar saw him in the doorway and stopped short. He drew his gun. He aimed at Jandrin.
"You get out," he mouthed. "Why in... can't you stay dead?"
"Put that gun down, you idiot," Jandrin managed to retort. The girl stopped and seemed trying to understand.
"We can get away yet if we all stick together." "Are you going to get out and leave me alone?"
demanded the journalist, holding his gun steadily enough. Jandrin, wholly indifferent, watched the muzzle. Vague curiosity possessed him. Just what, he wondered, did it feel like to be shot? Mar pulled the trigger.
Snap.
The cartridge misfired. Not even powder would burn. Mar laughed horribly and shambled forward.
"Serves him right," he mouthed. "He'd better not come back again."
Jandrin understood that Mar had seen him fall, but still, he felt himself standing there, alive. He shuffled away from the door. No matter whether he was alive or dead, there was always Vivian to be saved. The journalist came to the door, paused, looked down, grunted, and passed into the camp. He shut the door. Jandrin heard the rotten wooden bar of the latch drop. From within echoed a laugh, monstrous in its brutality. Then, quivering, the geologist felt a touch on his arm.
"Why did you desert us like that?"
he heard Vivian's reproach.
"Why?"
He turned, hardly able to see her at all.
"Listen," he said thickly. "I'll admit anything. It's all right, but just forget it for now. We've got to get out of here. The professor's dead in there, and Mar's gone mad and barricaded himself in there, so there's no use staying. There's a chance for us yet. Come along."
He took her by the arm and tried to draw her toward the river, but she held back. The hate in her face sickened him. He shook in the grip of a mighty chill.
"Go with you?"
she demanded.
"Yes, by God," he retorted in a swift blaze of anger. "Or I'll kill you where you stand. It shan't get you anyhow."
Swiftly piercing,
A greater cold smote to his inner marrows. A long row of the cup-shaped prints had just appeared in the snow beside the camp, and from these marks wafted a faint, bluish vapor of unthinkable cold.
"What are you staring at?" the girl demanded. "Those prints in the snow there, see?"
He pointed a shaking finger.
"How can there be snow at this season?"
He could have wept for the pity of her, the love of her. On her red tam, her tangle of rebel hair, her sweater, the snow came steadily drifting. Yet there she stood before him and prated of summer. Jandron heaved himself out of a very slough of down-dragging lassitudes. He whipped himself into action.
"Summer, winter, no matter," he flung at her. "You're coming along with me."
He seized her arm with a brutality of desperation that must hurt to save. And murder, too, lay in his soul. He knew that he would strangle her with his naked hands, if need were, before he would ever leave her there for it to work its horrible will upon.
"You come with me," he mouthed, "or by the Almighty."
Mar's scream in the camp whirled him toward the door. That scream rose higher, higher, even more and more piercing, just like the screams of the runaway Indian guides in what now appeared the infinitely long ago. It seemed to last hours, and always it rose, rose, as if being wrung out of a human body by some kind of agony not conceivable in this world. Higher, higher. Then it stopped. Jandron hurled himself against the plank door. The bar smashed. The door shivered inward. With a cry, Jandron recoiled. He covered his eyes with a hand that quivered, claw-like.
"Go away, Vivian. Don't come here. Don't look."
He stumbled away, babbling. Out of the door crept something like a man. A queer, broken, bent-over thing. A thing crippled, shrunken, and flabby, that whined. This thing, yes, it was still Mar, crouched down at one side, quivering, whimpering. It moved its hands as a crushed ant moves its antenna, jerkily, without significance. All at once, Jandron no longer felt afraid. He walked quite steadily to Mar, who was breathing in little gasps. From the camp issued an odor unlike anything terrestrial. A thin, grayish grease covered the sill. Jandron caught hold of the crumpling journalist's arm. Mar's eyes leered, filmed, unseeing. He gave the impression of a creature whose back has been broken, whose whole essence and energy have been wrenched asunder, yet in which life somehow clings, palpitant. A creature vivisected. Away through the snow, Jandron dragged him. Mar made no resistance, just let himself be led, whining a little, palsied, rickety, shattered. The girl, her face whitely cold as the snow that fell on it, came after. Thus, they reached the landing at the river.
"Come now, let's get away," Jandron made shift to articulate.
Mar said nothing. But when Jandron tried to bundle him into a canoe, something in the journalist revived with swift, mad hatefulness. That something lashed him into a spasm of wiry, incredibly venomous resistance. Slavers of blood and foam streaked Mar's lips. He made horrid noises, like an animal. He howled dismally and bit, clawed, writhed, and groveled. He tried to sink his teeth into Jandron's leg. He fought appallingly, as men must have fought in the inconceivably remote days even before the Stone Age. And Vivian helped him. Her fury was a tiger cat's. Between the pair of them, they almost did him in. They almost dragged Jandron down, and themselves too, into the black river that ran swiftly sucking under the ice. Not till Jandron had quite flung off all vague notions and restraints of gallantry, not until he struck from the shoulder,
to kill if need were, did he best them. He beat the pair of them unconscious, trussed them hand and foot with the painters of the canoes, rolled them into the larger canoe, and shoved off. After that, the blankness of a measureless oblivion descended.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SPINQUEST.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Only from what he was told weeks after in the Royal Victoria Hospital at Montreal did Jandrin ever learn how and when a field squad of Dominion foresters had found them drifting in Lake Musawamkeag, and that knowledge filtered slowly into his brain during a period inchoate as Iceland fogs. That Mar was dead and the girl alive, that much, at all events, was solid. He could hold to that. He could climb back with that to the real world again. Jandrin climbed back, came back. Time healed him, as it healed the girl. After a long, long while, they had speech together. Cautiously, he sounded her wells of memory. He saw that she recalled nothing. So, he told her white lies about capsized canoes and the sad death, in realistically described rapids, of all the party except herself and him. Vivian believed. Fate, Jandrin knew, was being very kind to both of them. But Vivian could never understand in the least why her husband, not very long after marriage, asked her not to wear a wedding ring, or any ring whatever. Men are so queer, covers a multitude of psychic agonies. Life for Jandrin, life softened by Vivian, knit itself into some reasonable semblance of a normal pattern. But when, at lengthening intervals, memories even now awake, memories crawling amid the slime of cosmic mysteries that it is madness to approach, or when at certain times Jandrin sees a ring of any sort, his heart chills with a cold that reeks of the horrors of infinity. And from shadows past the boundaries of our universe seem to beckon things that, God grant, can never, till the end of time, be known on Earth. You've been listening to The Thing from Outside by George Allen England. George Allen England, February 9th, 1877 to June 26th, 1936, was an American writer and explorer, best known for his speculative fiction. There is so much cool shit in this story. Lost time, characters contemporaneously experiencing different seasons, fluctuations in perceived reality that might not just be hallucinations. It's almost as if the characters start living in parallel versions of the same event, details slipping into and out of their increasingly divergent experiences. This is stuff that would seem forward-thinking even in the 1970s, but in the 1920s? Get out of here. You know I love my Lovecraft, but I gotta say, as far as truly weird fiction goes, this blows the pants off almost all of Lovecraft's offerings. I hope that you enjoyed this strange time capsule as much as I did. Though I'm about 90 years too late, I extend my thanks to George Allen England for one hell of a story. Also, thanks to you fine folks for joining me. I'll be back with more Horror Hill next week, and until then, stay spooky.
You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. And we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That 2-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.